Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Breaking news. The Cleveland Browns are back in the postseason, and that's obviously awesome. The playoffs are better. Life is better when the Browns are back where they belong. So now the somber note. I hate to start the program with the ultimate kick in America's package, but I have to read the following statement released by America's team moments ago, and I quote, "The Cleveland Browns were informed this morning that head coach Kevin Stefanski, two additional members of the coaching staff, and two players have tested positive for COVID-19. Our facility is currently closed while contact tracing is taking place. The team will continue to consult with the league and medical experts to determine the appropriate next steps. As the health and safety of our players, coaches, staff, and the entire community remains our highest priority. Our contingency planning calls for special teams coordinator Mike Prefer to serve as the acting head coach." End of quote. There are gut punches, and then there's that. Getting to the playoffs and then losing your head coach and two other members of the coaching staff and two more players, and the facility has been closed yet again. As of right now, that playoff game in Pittsburgh is still on for Sunday night. Now, I'm not sure if I'd call that a full-blown nightmare scenario for the league, but losing a head coach, two other coaches, and two players for a playoff game is pretty damn close to a nightmare scenario, especially since moving the game really does not seem to be an option at this point. Now, for Cleveland, it is brutal. Absolutely brutal. 18 years without the postseason, and now this happens. Now, this is a team that has battled through so many challenges, including positive tests and facility closings over the course of the entire year, and yet they keep finding a way to win. They found a way to get it done. They found a way to get in. I've mentioned before, Odell Beckham Jr. lost for the season. They keep right on winning. Nick Chubb misses four games. They keep right on doing their thing. And now this. And it is rough. Really, really rough, because Stefanski is not just your head coach. He's way more than that to that team. He's the play caller, and no team wants to lose their head coach before a playoff game. I would argue that other teams could survive that more easily than the Browns can because of what this guy means to that team. He means so much to the team and the organization overall. There's a reason why Stefanski is one of the hottest names to win Coach of the Year, because this guy shapes and defines the identity of that entire team, the organization. And now when the team needs him the most, he's unable to participate due to the pandemic. As always, saying something sucks is not a take. This sucks. I mean, this really sucks. Now, having said that, I want to be very clear about this. If you think the Cleveland Browns are going to give up, if you think the Browns are going to tap because their head coach is not available for that playoff game against Pittsburgh, then you don't know the Cleveland Browns. Not the Cleveland Browns I know. Because I know this crew is not going to fold. Man, they're going to battle. They're going to grind. They're going to fight. They're going to move towards that battle. You want to run down a list of whack stats.
That's whack.
Whack stats about how much they've struggled against the Steelers in Pittsburgh when things were right. That's fine. Go ahead and do that. You do that. You can talk about the Steelers dominating the Browns in Pittsburgh, and I'm just going to go Derek Anderson on you and say, that's fine. That's fine. About a billion times. That's fine. You know why? Because that is fine.
That's fine.
In fact, that's great. The Cleveland Browns don't just want to be in the playoffs. They want to beat the Steelers in the playoffs. You see that as an obstacle. They'll see it as an opportunity. Man, they're not going to feel sorry for themselves because they know nobody else will. The obstacle is the way. The only way out is right through. They don't want to back into a Super Bowl win. They want to earn it. Bring it all on. Why the hell not at this point? Bring on all the challenges you have. Throw everything you've got at this crew. They're built for it. They're built differently. They are different. Don't come in here. And Browns fan, don't you do it either. Don't you come in here with, why is this happening? You can talk all you want about the Browns' struggles in the playoffs and the fact that they're snake bitten and whatever can't go wrong will go wrong. You can tell me that the Browns and the Browns fans will never, ever experience true happiness. That every time something goes wrong, about 10 other things go wrong. And I'm just going to call it noise, man. I'm going to call that junk. I'm going to call that what that is. So you can try to come in here and reset that screaming Browns fan.
Oh, my God, this is not happening. Oh, my God, this is not
I'm not having it. I'm not having it. That's the old way of thinking. Those are the old Cleveland Browns. This is a new year. This is a new team. And it's still America's team. Now, don't get me wrong. Losing Kevin Stefanski and two more coaches and two more players is serious. Really serious. This is a pandemic. The virus is absolutely no joke at all. It is dangerous. And my immediate concern is for their speedy recovery and a return to full health. But if you think the Cleveland Browns and their fans are going to melt down about this, you're wrong. Because this crew has been forged in fire. They're battle-tested. They've gone through all these losses, all these quarterbacks, all these head coaches. They've come out the other side finally. They're stronger for it. They're better for it. Man, iron sharpens iron. They're ready to swing their sword. Again, the health and safety of the coaches is the most important thing. But after that, it doesn't matter who's available and who's not available. Man, they're going to show up. They're going to battle. I see you haters. I hear you haters. I read you haters. I feel you haters. The drive, the fumble, the move, and now the Rona, the positive. If you think I'm bailing, you don't know me, and you don't know America's team. Yeah, it sucks, but we're not going to tap. We're not going to tap. C-Town, get up in here. I'm not fighting this battle by myself. John Hammond. John, it's great to have you on the show. How are you, John?
Hey, Jim, I'm doing well. That intro made me feel good, especially when you said we're in first place right now. So, no complaints.
Yeah, you are in first place. Great to have you on, John. Thanks so much. Now, the team is coming off a 102, or I should say 103-83 win over Cleveland last night. It snapped a two-game losing streak. After the four-game winning streak to start the year, you followed up that with a couple of losses. So, how pleased were you with the way the guys bounced back last night?
You know, Jim, how it goes. Every win is a good win. And last night's win was good to get at home. We have a little home stretch here, and you want to take advantage of it when you're at home. So good to get the win last night. We have Cleveland again tomorrow night here at home, and hopefully we can play well.
We're talking to John Hammond. You know, John, Aaron Gordon had 24 and 11 rebounds last night, but in particular, he had six threes. I'm curious, when he's hitting like that from deep, how much does that change the entire game for this team?
Wow, Jim, and, you know, it's such a factor in the league today overall. You know, you see a score, and a surprising score, and the first thing you do is you check the box and look at three-point shooting. And when a team struggles from the three-point line, it's such a major factor in our game. And for an individual player like Aaron, when he can come out and shoot the ball like that, what that does for us offensively, it just it takes our team to another level. So we need more of that out of him, and boy, when he gives it to us, because you know Aaron can do so many other things around the basket with his strength, his offensive rebounding. So when he's shooting the three, he's a very dominant player.
Orlando Magic GM John Hammond is joining us. You know, John, it's only seven games in, so it's not a huge sample size. But how would you describe the identity of the team so far?
Well, you know, our teams are kind of the personality of our coach a little bit, Steve Clifford, and that means we're going to be a team that I think we're going to play hard most every single night. We're going to compete. Hopefully, we're not going to turn the ball over at a very high rate, and then we're going to be very, very solid defensively. And then on the offensive end, you know, he gives our guys some freedom offensively, and I like that philosophy. You know, I think the philosophy of like you can only demand you can't beat them up on the defensive end. and then not giving some freedom on the offensive end. So I think that's what he does, and I think guys enjoy playing that way.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, don't make a shake, don't eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender, and it's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors: old-fashioned, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy. So next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for it in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying that way. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? I was going to say, John, that this is a big Steve Clifford house. I love the guy. I've always enjoyed my conversations with him over the years. And I think you just did a really good job of describing what he brings to it. What else can you say about him and what he means to the team and the organization? Why do you like him so much?
Well, you know, he's one of those guys. In my years in this business, you know, working as a coach and in the front office, you know, you see these guys that what players are looking for is they're looking for their leadership, and the leadership is preparation. And that's what Steve Clifford does, is that he prepares as well as anybody, I think, in the business. And guys respect that. And I think the fact that when he walks up into a meeting or onto the practice floor or into a pregame practice, that they know for sure he's done his work, he's prepared. And I think it makes them, it helps them to become more accountable as well, because he's definitely accountable.
Actually, I think that's fascinating what you just said, that leadership is preparation. Like, for instance, yesterday I was speaking with former NFL executive Michael Lombardi, and one of the topics that we got into is the importance of the relationship between the head coach and the GM in the NFL. So how would you describe the relationship you have with Steve Clifford and also with Jeff Weltman, who you'd worked with in the past?
Yeah, it's you know, Jeff and I, we this is our fifth time working together in the NBA, so we have a long-time relationship. You know, I know him well. He knows me well. There's a real comfort zone there. And with Cliff, you know, Cliff is he's an interesting guy, because he's got, you watch him on the sideline, he's got that kind of that tough demeanor to him. But he's also, one thing about him, he's also a very engaging guy. So he likes people. He loves connecting with people. He's a great storyteller. He's got a great sense of humor, and I think that's also important in coaching and in coaching today's athlete, that someone that can connect. So he holds guys accountable, but he also is a connector, and I think that's really important.
I think that's all true. That's from the outside looking in. That's the way I've always seen him, John. I think that those who know, but I think those who aren't really exactly sure don't have any idea how insanely underrated he is as a head coach. Now, if you and I were to go back, you also worked with another one of the most fascinating people ever in basketball. Back in the day, you were an assistant with Larry Brown with the Clippers, and I love Larry Brown. You know this. You know this about me. But especially when he was with the Clippers, what was that particular experience like for you, and what was your biggest takeaway of spending time with him?
You know, I had two stints with Larry. One as an assistant coach, and then as our coach in Detroit when I was working with Joe Dumars in the front office, we won our championship. But Jimmy, I've told people about being with Larry, in particular that time in Los Angeles with the Clips. You know, we were a struggling team at that time. They made the change at All-Star break. We had some very good young players on the roster. And at that time, he came in, and Jim, I sat next to him every game, and I still didn't know exactly how it was happening, how he turned that team around and that organization around at that time. And for the next 2 years, we were a playoff team because of Larry Brown and the players on our roster. But, you know, just an amazing teacher. And it was ironic. You know, I remember, like, then going to an SMU practice. Fast forward, you know, post-Clippers, post-Pistons, now he's coaching the SMU, walked into the practice, sat down for 10 minutes, and I listened to him teach. And Jim, teaching the exact same way and teaching the exact same things he was teaching you years back in the mid-90s with the Clippers, early 2000s with the Pistons winning a championship, and now at SMU doing the same thing. Just consistent teaching, a brilliant basketball mind, and a great person.
Talking to John Hammond, it's so true, right, John? He's always been known as one of the great, great teachers in the game. I can remember at those times when he would come on this show and understand that he was about the biggest thing in the world, one of the greatest coaches ever, even at that time, and especially at that time. And he would say things to me like, you know, Jim, what I really want to do ultimately is I'm going to end up coaching high school basketball. And I used to laugh at that, but it's not that far-fetched, right? Because he's the ultimate teacher. I could see ultimately, like, he may be at SMU right now, but I could see ultimately where before he calls it a day, John, he might end up coaching high school basketball somewhere.
You know, Larry, I'll never forget, we were sitting in Phoenix after a shoot around, and our beat writer from the LA Times came up to Larry after that shoot around, and we were sitting outside, and he said, Coach, how are you liking Los Angeles? How are you enjoying coaching the Clippers? And because of Larry's nomadic ways, of course, people ask that question. Larry's response was, if I've said this once, I've said it 100 times since. He said, you know, it doesn't matter what level you're coaching at, high school, college, or pro, and it doesn't matter where you're living. If you're winning, coaching's great. If you're losing, coaching stinks. And I agree with you, you know. I just think the guy, who knows what he could do, still a great basketball mind. And I know he loves the game. He studies the game. It's a shame he's not coaching.
I appreciate your thoughts on that. John Hammond joining us. A couple more moments. John, your journey to this point is really amazing in that you suffered a motorcycle accident in high school, which meant that you missed your senior year of basketball. Then you went to college at Greenville, and then you hear about this opportunity in Pawnee City, Nebraska. How did you hear about that, and what was that like?
Wow, Jim, you're going so, so far back. You know, I was looking for a teaching job, and I wanted to be honest with you, I thought if I could fulfill my life's dream, I'd like to be a high school basketball coach in Illinois or maybe Indiana. And at that time, there was an overabundant supply of teachers. I had a connection with the gentleman who was the superintendent of schools in my hometown, Zion, Illinois, a small suburb north of Chicago. He said, look, if you want a head coaching job right out of college, go to Nebraska. They need teachers. They need coaches. I did that. And go to this, you know, little farm town in Nebraska, Pawnee City, and thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? What's going to happen with my career here? I caught the luckiest break ever. I had a chance to go on to be a graduate assistant. That's a long story in itself. I had a chance to go on to be a graduate assistant at the University of Nebraska. I go there my first year. The head coach at that time, Joe Cipriano, legendary coach, gets sick and is unable to coach. I go from a graduate assistant coach to an assistant coach in a matter of months, after being in Pawnee City. So then 11 years in college and then 11 years coaching in the NBA and then moved into the front office. So, Jim, I'm literally one of the luckiest guys around to be doing what I've done and feel so fortunate and happy to be here.
A truly amazing journey. He was named GM of the Orlando Magic in 2017. The Orlando Magic are in first place in the Southeast, and they are at home against Cleveland tomorrow. John Hammond, my guest. John, great to finally have you on the show. Thank you very much. Hope we can do it again soon, John.
Thanks, Jim. I've been listening to you for years, and I've always appreciated you. Thank you very much.
If you were drawing up a list of people that were happy about Doug Peterson's senior night act with Nate Sudfeld against Washington on Sunday, that list would be pretty short. In fact, it would be a really, really short list. You'd have to think that Nate Sud himself was pretty pleased to get some of that game action. Put him on the list. And then Doug was probably glad that he was able to get that guy who had been there for 4 years some snaps. So put him on the list. At least that was the crap that Peterson was shoveling after the game. Yeah, I want to get Nate in there. Like I said that I would before the game because he's been here 4 years, so he deserved some snaps. And again, I love this notion that, yeah, well, I said that I was going to do it. Like somehow that provides cover for this guy. Now, again, why did you do it? Just saying that you were going to do it does not make it right. Why did you do it? So probably Dougie P was happy. Probably Nate Sud was happy. And probably there were members of the Eagles front office who were pleased with that move because let's be real. Once again, the sixth pick in the draft is definitely better than the ninth pick. So there's your list of people happy with that move. Now, as long as we're being real, losing that game really was the best outcome for the future of the Eagles. The season was already a catastrophe. You may as well start prepping for next year and making sure that you can get the best picks you can. So in a strictly analytical sense, getting Nate Sudd into that game and making Nate Sudd, making sure that he lost that game, was a good analytical move. Problem is, this is not only about analytics, because it's also about the people, and more specifically, the 52 other guys in that locker room not named Nate Sudd, who didn't want the final game of the NFL season turned into high school senior night for the third stringer. You know, the guys who were out there playing for more than a participation trophy or a ribbon or a carton of Capri Sun. You know, the dudes who are professionals. The dudes who are out there not tanking for a better draft pick. The dudes who are out there because they are professional and they're wired to compete and win and do their jobs and beat the guy in front of them, regardless of the situation, every time they step on the field. You know, pretty much what every other guy in that locker room was doing, especially in the last game of the season, especially in prime time, especially against a rival, especially in a game that had playoff implications for others. But there was weird Dougie P selling after the game that he really did want to win. He really was trying his hardest to win. And he was trying to get Nate Sudd some snaps because, you know, he had been there for 4 years. He had been there for 4 years and wanted to get him some snaps. I mean, never mind that that was both a lie and the lamest take ever. Because it's both those things. It's a lie and the lamest take ever. Except that, in and of itself, was not enough because this guy was not done. In fact, yesterday, Peterson had a new explanation as to why Nate Sudd got into that game. And that new explanation made a bad situation even worse. Much worse.
We were struggling just a little bit to move the ball. Defensively, they kept us in the game with a couple of takeaways late. And my plan was to get Nate in the game. Nate's a guy that is very capable of running our system and executing and an opportunity to pull that game out.
Like, I didn't think there could be an explanation worse than wanting to get Nate a few snaps because he had been there for 4 years. But this is worse. Because now what he's saying is, it wasn't just a charity case. It was actually that he thought that the third stringer could help. He thought that the third stringer gave them their best chance to win. What? This guy hasn't played all year. He had thrown two passes since the end of the 2017 season. Are you kidding me with that, Doug? The guy's thrown two passes since the end of the 2017 season, but you think he's going to give you a better chance to win? The hell made you think that he was the guy that was going to pull that game out? If he's, quote, very capable of running our system and executing, then why had he been averaging less than one pass attempt per season until Sunday night? If he's so capable, why are you letting this guy throw one pass a year? And by the way, it's not like your guy came in and lit it up either. The guy who's supposed to be so capable threw a pick on a second pass, fumbled a snap on the second possession, was sacked twice, averaged 3 yards per pass attempt. In other words, he was who the rest of us and the rest of your team thought he was. Nate Sudfeld, third stringer. Hey, Doug, a little free advice. When you're in a bleeping hole, stop digging. Because that explanation was more idiotic than the one you tried to float right after the game. Like, the only thing worse than putting him out there as some sort of reward for being with the team for 4 years is putting him out there because you thought that he could win. You thought that he could help you when you knew he couldn't. I mean, do we all look that stupid to you? Maybe we do. Maybe you thought you could Jedi mind trick the rest of us with that bullcrap. Maybe you thought that because you won a championship, you've got license to lie to all of us and insult all of us. That's fine. I mean, who are we? What do we matter, right?
That's fine.
I mean, we're all one thing. That's fine. What do we all matter? I'll tell you the guys who do matter. The guys who do matter are the guys in your own locker room. The guys who do matter are the guys on your own coaching staff. I'm curious what they all think. And if you're wondering how the Nate Sudd experience went down with them, we're starting to get a better idea. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the answer is it went pretty horribly. Jeff McClain reports, quote, many Eagles players and coaches were shocked and outraged, end quote. It's like every coach and GM talks about the importance of culture. I'm not sure that your culture should involve being, quote, shocked and outraged when you describe the vibe in your locker room. That's usually the reaction you get when you realize the head coach not only does not care if he wins, but is actually trying to lose. And it gets worse. According to McClain, Jason Kelce and another offensive starter went to Peterson and asked him why he pulled the starting quarterback in a one-score game. How often do you see that? Multiple offensive players rolling up on the head coach during a game like, yo, man, the hell are you doing? Why did you do that? Now, while I wasn't there, I'm guessing that if he gave them the same answer that he gave the rest of us, I'm guessing they were not fired up over this notion of getting Nate Sudd some snaps because he's been here 4 years. Yeah, I'm guessing Kelce didn't want to hear that. Oh, Doug, you mean the third stringer who's been here for 4 years. Why didn't you say so? Oh, hell yeah. Definitely get him into the game. That makes sense. My bad. Now, I'm sorry. My bad. And then there's more. Quote, two defensive players had to be held back from approaching Peterson. All right, so I want to stress the word choice. Like, there's a big difference between two defensive players having to be held back from Peterson and two defensive players having to be held back from approaching Peterson, right? One is two guys looking to fight the head coach. The other is two guys looking to talk to the head coach. But if somebody is being, quote, held back from approaching the head coach, that tells me there was something about the way that they were looking to approach him that made other people think, yeah, we better hold them back. We better stop them. Otherwise, they would just let them talk to the head coach, right? Like, if you're approaching the head coach to thank him for getting the third stringer some reps, I don't think anybody is looking to hold you back. If those two guys were looking to rush up and congratulate the head coach on securing the sixth pick overall instead of the ninth pick, I don't think anybody would be looking to hold them back. And of course, the last question is, how did all of this play with the guy who was taken out of the game for Nate Sudd, Jalen Hurts? The guy who might be, the guy who could be, the guy who maybe isn't the quarterback of the future? McClain reported on that too. Quote, Hurts was distraught as well. Hurts was distraught. Even though he had been told Wednesday that there was a chance Sudfeld could play, he couldn't understand why Peterson would make the switch. Sources close to the situation said, the NBC broadcast caught Hurts on the bench after he was replaced, apparently saying, quote, that's not right. I mean, you don't need to be a lip reader to see that's exactly what he said. Quote, that's not right. That's awesome. The potential quarterback of the future is, quote, distraught. And that's in addition to the other quarterback, Carson Wentz, reportedly being so pissed with Peterson that their relationship cannot be healed and he wants out. I mean, that's incredible. The only quarterback in Philly who is happy with Peterson right now is Nate Sudd. And I'm guessing even he's bent because of the position the coach put him in and all the crap he's taking right now. Again, what's amazing to me is this is Doug Peterson we're talking about, a guy who won a Super Bowl as one of the brassest head coaches of all time, a guy who was an absolute legend after that, a guy who would have never had to buy another beer in that town for the rest of his life, probably another meal in that town for the rest of his life. This guy could have rode that win for decades. And now he's got players questioning him, others having to be held back, and his quarterback room is raging. not to mention actual questions about his job security. How the hell is that even possible? This guy won the Eagles a Super Bowl. Remember when Jason Kelce was screaming his lungs out about Peterson? Remember when Eagle fans were in the streets eating horse crap to celebrate this guy's genius? How popular was this guy? How smart was this guy? How successful was this guy? People weren't toasting to him. They were eating horse crap to him. Man, that's my guy. I love this guy. I think I'll eat a horse crap sandwich. How did that guy fall that far that fast? Because that right there is some Adam Gase bull bleep right there. Hope that was all worth it. Hope that was all worth it to move up three spots in the draft. Obviously, it is to Peterson. Obviously, it is to the organization, or they would not have put Nate Sudd in the first place. I mean, given the damage you've done to your reputation and the locker room and even arguably to the sport overall, man, you better get that draft pick right, Dougie. Because after all that, that's what this is about, right? And nothing else. Not trying to win, but about moving up in the draft. Do not screw up that draft pick, Dougie, because you just lit that entire joint on fire to get it.
It's lit!
I guess we got to give him credit for actually putting a quarterback in. An actual quarterback, you know, to maintain the sanctity of the game. Although Greg Ward, their wide receiver, did play quarterback in college. He might have been better. At least he didn't go all triple G and call a bunch of bonehead, look at me, defensive calls. And then again, to be fair, I know I'm being kind of harsh here, but to be fair, we are talking about Nate Sudd. We are talking about Nate Sudfeld. You know, maybe we shouldn't be acting like he put Nate Peterman in. Hey, you want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back that you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year automatically, with no limit on how much you can earn. I mean, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you consider all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So, when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations do apply. If you've listened to this show for any amount of time, you know that I'm fascinated by the process of these elite athletes that I talk to and talk about. I'm fascinated by their process. I'm fascinated by the way they prepare. I'm fascinated by the way they fuel their moneymaker. Body is temple. You know all that. I talk about this all the time. I'm really curious what these guys fuel with. You know, what they eat, how they rest, how much sleep they get, how they recover, and especially what they eat. The fuel that they use. You know, you've got guys like my man, James Lightning Wilkes, who is completely plant-based. And you've got other athletes who've gone plant-based that didn't used to be. You know, and then you've got other guys like who play on the line. I've talked to Nick Hardwick, and you've heard Joe Thomas tell the stories about how when they played the game and they had to maintain weight, that was a full-time job, that these guys would literally eat sleeves and sleeves of Girl Scout cookies, pints of ice cream in bed at 11 o'clock at night, or they'd set their alarm at 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning to slam protein shakes, anything they could to keep the weight on. And then you've got somebody like Keith Smith of the Atlanta Falcons, who says that he slams Chipotle 4 to 5 times a day. I mean, to me, it's all fascinating what guys have to do to fuel up. So naturally, when North Carolina quarterback and somebody on the 2021 Heisman shortlist, Sam Howell, is talking about what he's eating, then I'm all ears. Great player, great kid, coming off an 8-win season in a shortened year, and definitely a player to watch next year. So when WTVD 11 asked him what he fuels up on. I was curious to see the response, and this is how he answered.
Is that true? That's all you have is chicken?
Yeah, I mean, people give me a hard time, but the only meat I eat is chicken. You know, it's been like that my whole life. So yeah, chicken is the only meat I eat. I only go to restaurants that serve something with chicken on the menu.
What is your favorite way of having chicken?
Like chicken tenders or chicken nuggets, you know, from like Chick-fil-A or something. Chick-fil-A is probably my go-to for chicken.
It's one thing to say, I only eat chicken, you know, chicken breast, lean chicken. I mean, again, what he's saying is no red meat, no fish, just chicken and lots of it. And deep fried, though. Tenders and nugs. So one of his teammates was in the interview with Sam as well, and said that not only is this true, not only is Sam only about chicken, Sam will bring his own chicken. And not just bring his own chicken, but bring his own chicken to steak and lobster victory dinners.
On Sundays, after we get a win, we have victory dinner. We're sitting around eating lobster and having steak, and Sam comes in. He has his chicken tenders coming around because that's the only meat he eats, and we give him a hard time about it every Sunday. You're like, yep, you got your chicken tenders. You got your victory meal.
I'd be like, great, man. That's fine. Who gets the steak? Who gets Sam's lobster? That's commitment, though, right? I mean, I've seen guys. Remember I mentioned James Lightning Wilkes? Lightning would come on the road with us sometimes to Super Bowl, and we'd work out, and he was kind of like my guru. He'd bring his own food on the road. You know, I'm like room servicing it up, and I'm trying to be responsible, and I'll go like egg whites if I feel like I'm some kind of legend. My man's bagged up his own food and brought it with him on the road. That's commitment. Sam Howell bringing his own nugs to a steak and lobster victory dinner is commitment. Kawhi Leonard allegedly bringing 12 red apples and a fork and a knife to a team dinner is impressed by that commitment. Now, what's interesting about the chicken obsession from Sam is that he is not alone. Far from it. There are people who research these types of things, and right now chicken is selling at twice the rate that beef is, and the gap seems to be getting bigger every single month. Like, maybe you remember the great chicken sandwich war of 2019. Chick-fil-A was dominating the scene all by itself, and the gold standard was that fried chicken sando. Remember that? Then KFC jumped into the fray. They jumped into the arms war. They dropped theirs, but instead of bread for a bun, they used a couple of glazed donuts. They brought glazed donuts to a chicken fight. You know how that went, man. Really well. Really well. Then Popeyes looked around, got tired of getting dunked on. So they released a chicken sando that literally caused violence in the streets. Lines were wrapped so far around the building that people would go into the store, buy as many as they were allowed. Like, there was a limit on how many you could have. And then they would flip them. They would resell them for triple the price to people waiting outside. That was a real thing. Somebody got stabbed. That was a real thing. Hate to say it, but one of the more American things in recent memory. People waiting in line and then gouging others who didn't want to wait in line for chicken sandos. Literally and financially. So since 2019, the chicken sandwich war has kind of cooled off. Chicken fanatics have sampled everything. They picked their favorite sandwich. They went back to their normal drive-through lines and habits. The crowds dispersed, evened out. People are no longer gouging each other financially and literally. But now we're set for a brand new heavyweight to come in. Apparently somebody is coming in late to this fight. And they're coming in and they're swinging. They're ready to give the hands. The clown, Ronnie Mack, and his golden arches of cholesterol finally entering the space. Better late than never, I guess. Finally. So why? Why now? Why is this happening now? In a news release published yesterday, McDonald's is dropping three different fried chicken sandos next month. Three. Because apparently McDonald's took a bath in 2020 and they lost 2% of their customers to other fast food chains that offered a comparable product. It's a big number, 2%. So this is my favorite part of the article yesterday. Apparently, franchise operators were sick of hemorrhaging money, and they all got together, and they contacted the president of Mickey D's, and they said this. They sent off this email. This is word for word from that email. Quote, JFK called for a man on the moon. Our call should be a category-leading chicken sandwich. End quote. It's incredible. These franchise owners just invoked JFK and a moon landing in the Cold War for a chicken sandwich. It's exactly why the chicken sandwich space is referred to as a war. Because apparently, that's exactly what that is. Especially if these franchisees are invoking JFK and a moon landing. Americans are leaving beef for the bird. McDonald's is getting lapped. Their owners went all JFK with it and called for their own moon landing. It's amazing, right? And corporate listened. Because next month, the biggest fast food chain in the world is poised to cause a Popeyes-level disruption in the chicken sando game. So, if you're on your New Year's diet, good luck to you. If you're on a Sam Howell diet, pace yourself. Man, the obsession's real. And the biggest cat in the industry is finally showing up for this war. Better late than never. I can't wait. Hey, Matt in Vancouver, phone lines are open. I can't wait for Team Canada to weigh in on this. Hey, Tyler in Shredmonton. It's been a minute. If you've been waiting for a reason to call, now you have it. Chris in Toronto, even you would qualify. I need a call. You know who I need a call from? As long as we're talking about the chicken wars, how about I get a phone call from the chicken man?
Romy, they call me the chicken man.
Really? Why?
I have been on a bit of a healthy kick as of late, and all I do is eat chicken for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I am practically bringing these poor fowls to the brink of extinction. Not to mention the fact that the chicks love me, and I have a big rooster.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
Why did that guy get run?
Not a very good call.
Quote, I've been eating so much chicken, I'm on the verge of bringing these fowls to extinction. Not to mention the chicks love me. Why? Apparently he's got a big rooster. Not only did he say it, but he had to chase it with a pagah! Happy New Year, Rex. What's up?
Hey, Jimmy. Same leaf. You know, there's lots of Browns haters out there, and anytime you have a running back like Nick Chubb, you're going to be fine. The only thing that the Browns equipment crew needs to make sure of is that Nick doesn't get tripped up. So they need to ensure that his snake holster is in good working order. Anyways,
that's not a good call. No.
Anyways, you like you're right. Oh, same leaf.
Not a very good call.
As if Rex was going to have a call regarding Nick Chubb that was going to end any other way than with a snake holster. Let's go to Texas. Johnny in Texas. What's going on, Johnny? How are you?
Jimmy, dude, happy new year, man. Welcome back. Welcome back to the XR4TI.
Thank you very much, Johnny. Happy new year to you. What's going on?
Appreciate you. Hey, listen, end of the show yesterday, Chris in Southeast Wisco called. You know, Chris, just a few words for you. All the clones know that you're a reader. It's kind of like what we talk about on the back channels of the internet. Not that we talk about you too much, but all the clones know you're working on your script for the smack off and all that. But let me tell you something. With that sandpiper voice of yours, the only thing I can imagine you doing, quite frankly, is that blow-up doll in bed that you got, and you're just over there, oh, God, baby, I just want to. You know, dude, next time you call, why don't you mix in the throat lozenge or two? Jim, in my opinion, the only thing that Chris and Wisco qualifies for is a golden doodle. And you know what that is? That's a labradoodle for bitches. War, Jeremy in Green Bay, winning a golden ticket this year. War, me flying to Brazil for one of them homegrown Brazilians. And War, Mock Moda introducing me to one of those country girls so I can show her what a real russet looks like.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Calvin, what were you waiting on? You know, Alvin, you've got the hammer. I get the sense that Hawk is back there saying, no, let him go, let him go, let him go. Because obviously I've got no say in this because I would have ran that guy probably 5 minutes earlier. Alvin's response to me is, sorry, dude, I got frozen at Golden Doodle. Kurt in New Hampshire. Hey, Kurt, how are you?
I am wonderful, sir. Much respect over the years. Let me make it quick and brief, but to the point. More violence in the NFL. Remember back in the heyday, I bleed silver and black, by the way. The Raiders used to hurt people. I'm not talking about just Jack Tatum. When they hit you, you didn't get up. The injury report was long. Most teams never won after they played the Raiders. Forget about what the Raiders won or lost. They kicked that ass. They took those names. And let me ask you, where are those teams? Now, much respect to you, Jim. Over the years, you have done well consistently. Much respect. Peace.
Thank you very much, Kurt. I appreciate that. Hey, I don't know. I mean, we could talk about the NFL, and we could talk about what would make that league better. It's still the biggest thing in the world, the NFL. And there are ways to improve that league. The league may need some other things or some new things or some different things. I don't think it needs more violence. I don't think the league is short on violence. I don't think the league is lacking violence. In fact, I've had this running conversation with D-Dub, my guy, and I would say it started about 5 years ago, literally about 5 years ago. And he and I would talk during games, and I would say, is it me or is this league so much more violent than it used to be? Bigger, stronger, faster, kill shots. And of course, the league knows this, and they've tried to make the game safer for a number of reasons. One, you want to make sure that you're doing everything you can to protect your players. Number two, as we learn more and more about brain trauma, they want to do everything they can to make the game safer. And also, let's face it, in terms of business and smart business, you want to make sure that your best skilled players remain on the field. So, Kurt, I mean, I know you're an old school Raider fan. Much respect to you. And I appreciate you following the program for as long as you have. I don't think the league needs more violence. I think it's violent enough. I think it's as violent as it's ever been. Their head coach is Brett Bielema. He joins us right now. Brett, it's been a minute. It's great to have you back. How are you, Brett?
I'm great, Jim. Thank you. Thanks. Great to be on, man. I've missed a lot of things about college football, but not be on with Jim Rome, this is a great opportunity, man.
Brett, it's great to have you back. It's been a long time, and it's really good to hear your voice. So let me ask you, you're from a small town about 180 miles away from Champaign, Illinois. How does it feel to be named the head coach then of the Illini? Does it feel like a homecoming?
It's been pretty special. Been well documented, but I was actually brought into this world in Silvis, Illinois, in Illini Hospital, if you can believe that. Came out fighting chicken pox on the 13th. I don't know if it was Friday the 13th, but I came out fighting. So it's been a great opportunity to come here in my home state and to come back into a division that I know very well and hopefully can have great results and bring a championship here to the Champaign.
We're talking to Brett Bielema. Brett, just so we're clear, the town that you grew up in was not that big. In fact, the story goes your family had 2,000 hogs on the farm, and there were fewer than 2,000 people in that town. So what was life like growing up there? What lessons did you take from those early days?
You know, more than anything, I actually did grow up in a small town environment on a farm about 8 miles outside of town. And, you know, the things my parents instilled in me, working every day with my father, more than anything, if you put in an honest day work, you're going to get an honest day's results and then never really skip a step, you know. I remember being on the farm and being given certain tasks from my father, and if he didn't do them right, it usually was going to mean that you're going to do it again. So kind of like taking over the program here at Illinois, one of the things that really jumped out to me in talking to our athletic director and Josh was just, hey, we're going to build this in a way to sustain success. We don't want a flash in the pan. We don't want a year of success. We want to build something that lasts, and that's exactly what we're going to set out to do.
We're talking to Brett Bielema. So, Brett, what about the program? The program itself has not had a winning season since 2011. So what was it about the job and the opportunity? What was it about that place that made you feel like you could have the kind of sustained success you're talking about?
Well, I think more than anything, Jim, is just, you know, to be able to however you want to say it, the potential that's here. You know, the roster, the environment, the city, the Illini Nation, all of the things that get you so excited about. They're hungry. They're eager. Josh has afforded me an opportunity to bring in a first-class staff. We'll do that. But really, I met with that team the first day after their last game, and I could see the pain in their eyes, but also the excitement. And it's really a division that I grew up in. This division as a player, as an assistant coach, as a coordinator, as a head coach at another institution. I've seen success. I've also competed against Illinois, and now to be able to join fences with this program and the people that are in it, it's truly an opportunity that came second to none. And for me to be able to walk in with that experience is a really good situation as well.
Illinois head coach Brett Bielema is joining us. You know, Brett, one of the things I always appreciated about our conversations over the years was your candor and your honesty. You got off to that amazing start as a head coach at Wisconsin. Let's not forget, you were a head coach at 32. You were a conference coach of the year in your first season. You won 17 of your first 18 games, and you said, quote, "I thought I was Vince Lombardi, Tom Landry, Bill Belichick, all wrapped up into one. We all grow up," end quote. It really is an amazing quote. I love that. How did you grow up? What was that process like? And having that success at such an early age?
Well, I think it really gave a perspective that you could only get by going through it. You know, I tell all of our coaches all the time, when you get an 18-year-old young man on campus, he only knows what he knows. They've all grown up in different homes. They've grown up in a different environment. Some had parents, some had no parents, some had grandparents, some had maybe an aunt or an uncle, someone that took them under their wing. Well, I reached, you know, that profession in a point of 32 years of age to be a head coach that not many people had been able to do. And to have success early was a direct result of a lot of the things I had learned, but also what I had not learned that I didn't know yet. And that's what I did is, you know, over the next several years, went on to have good success. You know, we ended up my last 3 years at Wisconsin winning 3 straight Big Ten titles. But part of that I wasn't even aware of is when I was being courted by other schools was we had done it with a APR that was the highest that you could achieve, 1,000 APR percentage, which has never been done. Three Big Ten titles have never been done since I did it, but it just won't be repeated again. So with that, I also know that we had failures. We did things that obviously weren't good enough at different points in my career that we know that you had setbacks, and to recognize, identify, and adjust is part of the process. And then we all grow. Now to be a 50-year-old head coach, I've got a beautiful wife with 2 kids that really give a perspective off the field too, just of what you want to accomplish and do with the rest of your life, and to have it here in Champaign and hopefully allow my 2 girls to grow up in this community and be a part of it is really special.
We're talking to Brett Bielema. You know, Brett, so you had that great run at Wisconsin, and then you mentioned the time briefly at Arkansas. I mean, you took over a program that was in a tough spot. You go to 3 bowl games, and then you get fired. But at the same time, after that happened, at the press conference, you were saying things like, "I'm a bigger fan of Arkansas now than ever. I'll work with whoever they end up naming if they want my help. I'll be here to help them moving forward as long as I'm not working someplace else." I'm curious, in that moment, in a real tough, challenging professional moment, how were you able to be so positive and so supportive of the program in that tough moment?
Well, as you know, Jim, it's not what happens in life. It's how you react to it. It was a very difficult moment, one that, you know, was a moment as I reflect back upon. I'm glad I handled it in the way I did. And it's because I really do believe that. You know, my oldest daughter was born in Fayetteville. Little did I know at the time that it was going to play out the way it did. After my departure, I did reach out to Coach Morris in his first year, sent a couple emails to and contacts to him just to let him know that, you know, if I was here to work, help him in any way, I would. And obviously now with Sam taking over there, Sam Pittman at Arkansas is a guy that was on my original staff and absolutely love Sam and what he stands for, and they had great success in this year, first year there. So I think it's easy to hate things in the past, but it's easier to love and accept. I wanted Arkansas to have nothing but success and still feel that way to today. But now my mission is here at Illinois. And because of the success I've had in my career, but also I think men are more defined by their moments of adversity than they are by success. So I probably take that really just in my 12 years as a head coach, I had 2 years that we didn't go to a bowl game, my first and my last at Arkansas. And it's those moments that are going to help me build on the moments that we have in front of us here.
These are all powerful messages. Brett Bielema is joining us. Now, after Arkansas, Brett, it would have been easy for you maybe to put your feet up, maybe relax, maybe enjoy life, but you went right back to work. In fact, you went to work for the Patriots. I know you're focused on the task at hand, but I'm really curious, the time with the Patriots and even the New York Giants, what was that experience like?
It was absolutely a game changer. You know, Jim, I really didn't know what I was going to do after I got let go. I had the opportunity to talk to Bill. He literally called me a couple days after I was let go, talked about, you know, just really everything other than coaching, about, you know, life and being able to overcome a moment like that. The way things played out 6, 7, 8 months later, whatever it was, you know, I had an opportunity to join and be a part of his staff. But I did quickly remember, you know, walking in the building at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and if you weren't sitting ready to do work at 5 a.m., it was like you were late. It's just a work environment that's second to none. People work out of cubicles. It's just a cool environment to jump into, and it was all football. You know, there was a different side to the NFL. There's a lot of positives that you come from the NFL, but it's a different world up there. And you know, Coach Belichick was tremendous to me and my family, an unbelievable opportunity. And then the transition 2 years later with Joe Judge with the New York Football Giants was exceptional to be a part of that and build it. But it really gave me a perspective in those 3 years that's going to be a tremendous resource for my time here at Illinois. It's a different game, NFL versus college, but coaching is coaching, people are people, and leadership is leadership, and those will all be a factor in what we do.
You know, Brett, Bill Belichick made a point of saying how thankful he was for the time that he had with you and the time that you worked together once you were hired at Illinois. And one of the things that came up a lot during your time in the NFL was your ability to connect with players. How do you describe that approach to connecting with players? Like, what are the areas where you're looking to connect with them on?
You know, I was really intrigued to go to the NFL because, you know, I'd never been on. I had a great NFL career as a player. I was with the Seahawks for 6 days before they cut me, so
right.
It was pretty short-lived. But I do think, you know, the thing that intrigued me about the NFL was working with guys that, you know, at the highest level of their profession. There were several of my former players in the building, so I had connection with them, but I wanted to build relationship with guys I didn't know. And here's what I learned in the NFL is those players are just like any player I had in college. They want to be great. And if you can give them one tool, you know, everybody carries a toolbox. Everybody's toolbox is different. But if you can give one guy one tool that he can become a better player, they'll love you, all right? They'll follow you and do whatever you ask them to do. And that doesn't matter what level you're at. So I really enjoyed getting the opportunity to work with so many different players that I'd never touched before or been around, different coaches, getting a chance that first year to navigate our way through and get a Super Bowl ring. Bill actually was kind enough to buy us a Super Bowl trophy and give it to us as coaches. So I have that Lombardi trophy will be in my office proudly displayed because it's a part of my past. But it's a working experience I can never replace.
So, Brett, what's it feel like to once again have your own program? And then what's a Brett Bielema-led Illinois football team going to look like?
It's absolutely awesome, Jim. I think the first part we had to do, it's such a unique world. This COVID world has brought changes to everybody. And college football isn't left alone, you know. So now you have a really, you know, and well-documented, one of my first ever, or really one of the first ever grad transfers that had great success was with us at Wisconsin, was Russell Wilson. And I learned the value in having a guy come back for a year that, you know, that maybe he didn't know or plan on and how much it can affect our program. Well, I had an entire senior class of, in a sense, grad transfers. They had a new coach coming in. They get to stay right here on campus. A number of those guys are staying with us. So that was first and foremost. I sat down with my staff, the staff I inherited from Lovey, and talked to each one of those guys. We've had some transition, but learned a lot about the program through them. And then now I've just continued to build on our roster that's currently here. I've added a few new guys that will be transitioning in with us in late January, and really been working nonstop. It's an early day and late night, but it's been nonstop, I think, engagement with the community, and not just on recruiting, but I've met with alumni. I've met with community leaders, I've met with donors, I've met with administration. It's a work day that's like no other, but it's a lot of fun and gets better every moment.
Hey, Brett, one last thought. What about the staff itself? You inherit part of that staff for sure. What's the process been like in assembling your staff, and what kind of qualities are you looking for in staff members?
You know, that was a part that, again, you know, through 50 years now as a head coach, when I was 32 and got a head job, I heard from a couple people, but be 50 now and in this profession for 25 years, I think I've heard from everybody and their cousin. Had a number of messages, people reaching out. I've never been one of those coaches that's a good old boy system. I've never really hired
any of my friends. I've never really worked with and hired many from the past. There are a few guys that have been with me that I brought forward. Mark Torsani, my CFO of the past, is my now chief of staff. I've hired a couple of people, Tony Peterson, our offensive coordinator. Even though we've not worked together, we've known each other for 20 years in this business. Bart Miller was one of my former grad assistants, who's now my offensive line coach. We'll add a few more people in the coming days, but I wanted to find the best people for Illinois. I wanted to build an Illini offense, an Illini defense, an Illini special teams. It really wasn't where I'd been in the past. So we're still a work in progress. I don't really hire resumes or I don't hire names. I hire people and I hire teachers. And I really don't care where they come from. I don't care what they, what the media or the social media says about who they are, what they are. I hire people that want to build champions. And that's what I've been focusing on.
He is the head football coach in Illinois. He was named head coach on December 19th. The journey continues. Brett Bielema back in the jungle for the first time in quite some time. Brett, so good to have you back. Really appreciate that. Glad you and I can start talking once again, and I know we will do it again once again soon.
Appreciate it, Jim. ILL.
Good night now!